Hi, this is Dr. Pedro Ramirez, editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Gynecological Cancer. And today I have the great pleasure of having back on the podcast Dr. Brian Slomovitz from Mount Sinai Medical Center Division of Gynecologic Oncology, Miami Beach, Florida. We're going to be talking about the November lead article for our journal titled Checkpoint Inhibitor Rechallenge in Advanced Endometrial Cancer: Revisiting the Immune Landscape Beyond First-Line Therapy. Brian, it's great to see you. Always a pleasure speaking with you. Again, thank you so much for submitting this really great article to our journal, and congratulations to you and the co-authors for publishing this really important information. So thank you again, and thank you for accepting our invitation.
Yeah, so Pedro, thank you so much for reviewing our article, giving us positive feedback and accepting it, and obviously for highlighting it as lead article in November. It's always an honor to be here to talk to you. I always remind people, like, you're one of my first teachers in this. So you I was a way back when, I'm not sure how, like 5 years ago, was it? No, a little more than that. We worked well together, and I learned a lot from you. So to be invited by you here is really an honor for me. So thank you for acknowledging our work.
Thank you so much, Brian. So lots of questions that we want to cover, and we'll get started right away. So you wrote this review along with your co-authors to address an important topic: how to manage patients after immune checkpoint inhibitors. Why did you think this was a relevant topic at this time?
Thank you for that. So, the treatment for endometrial cancer in the first line changed tremendously. March in 2023, at the SGO meeting in the afternoon, Ramez Eskander and Mansoor Mirza, one after the other, presented the RUBY trial, Mansoor Mirza, and GY018 or KEYNOTE-868, that was Ramez Eskander, immediately released on New England Journal. And from that point forward, we put in the first line management of this disease immunotherapy. So when you do, and before that, we knew it worked in the second line. But when you do that, it gives us better outcomes for our patients because the positive studies were positive. But it sort of immediately opens up the need for a better second line therapy, because while we were all using lenvatinib pembrolizumab, we were all using either some of the Garnet data with dostarlimab. But when you move that to the first line, the tremendous unmet need moves to the second line. Now, in particular, one of the things that we're seeing clinically, and when we talk to our colleagues and some retrospective studies, is increased use of immunotherapy after immunotherapy, whether it's single agent or being added to something. We could dive into the data more if you want, but we really need to figure out if that's the right thing to do. If it is, great, and we need to figure out the best way to do it. But more importantly, we need to figure out if it's not the best thing to do, if there's better options, that we stop using it in practice. Because ultimately, we all want what's best for our patients. And we need, in order to do that, we need to investigate what we're doing.
So Brian, in the first section of the article, you title "Post-Progression Dilemmas: Evidence Lagging Behind Practice." Can you tell us a little bit as to what did you mean by this?
So it's and again, thanks for highlighting that. And it's sort of, what I was just sort of alluding to. We moved IO into the first line. People didn't know what to do in the second line. A typical example is you have a patient on the RUBY regimen, carboplatin, paclitaxel, dostarlimab. There, the trial as written gives dostarlimab 3 years maintenance, and if they recurred, say 2 years later on dostarlimab. In practice, what we hear from people and what we're seeing being recommended is, okay, stop. Let's switch over to pembrolizumab, lenvatinib, because that may work in the second line. But again, that's this IO after IO strategy, which really hasn't been proven yet. We see some of it in lung and renal cancer, and it's based a little bit on biological considerations, but there's a lack of prospective data. There's a lack of good real-world evidence up to this point. So, we wanted to highlight this in the paper and really call to question what are the best ways moving forward.
So as you know, we have questions from the fellows in the journal. And this first question comes from Matteo Lovero in the Gemelli Hospital in Rome. He's asking, what mechanisms most plausibly drive the benefit of a rechallenge therapy?
Great. Well, that's a great question. That's sort of diving right into it, the science here, which is, it's great. I love talking about it because when we try to really figure out the answers here, we need to understand the sciences and the translational work. So it's probably multiple factors. Right. So first of all, there can be genetic changes such as something called B2M and JAK or JAK1/2 mutations. There may be an immunosuppressive microenvironment that's driven by VEGF upregulation. There may be an infiltration by regulatory T cells and myeloid derived suppressor cells, and they may all play a role into this resistance. In addition, there may be something called biologic differences. We know, and we're spending a lot of time looking at MLH1 mutations, whether it's caused by methylation or whether it could be caused by, for example, Lynch syndrome related DMR non-methylation. There's some early evidence to say that the methylated ones are less of a response, less immunogenic to checkpoint therapy than the ones that are Lynch-like. And there's also a high subclonal neoantigen burden, which that too can sort of hinder what we call hinder the T cell recognition. These may explain why rechallenge may be effective in certain patients. But maybe the rechallenge, you know, highlighted by these biologic mechanisms may need to be with a VEGF blockade, maybe need to be with a PARP inhibitor. It may need to be like dual checkpoint blockade. These things may what we call like modify the microenvironment and restore that sensitivity that we're seeing. But that was a great question.
So this next question comes from Itzi Villagra in Spain. And she says, you talked about GY018 and the RUBY trials. What do you think are the main reasons for disease progression for frontline chemotherapy plus immunotherapy in advanced or recurrent endometrial cancer?
Yeah, no, thanks for highlighting those two trials. And again, I called out the authors there. I want to also call out for DUO-E, one of our good friends, Shannon Weston, was the lead there, and for the ATTEND trial, Nicoletta Colombo. A lot of patients did great on these drugs, right? But we didn't get the cures we wanted to see. We still saw some progression after this frontline therapy. I really think a lot of these are biological in nature. As mentioned, some of the resistance can be caused by this defective antigen presentation, which can downstream result from or upstream B2M loss or JAK1/2 mutations. These can impair what we call impaired interferon signaling. Other patients may progress due to immunosuppressive microenvironments, high VEGF signaling, for example, infiltration by regulatory T cells and myeloid-derived suppressor cells, sort of like was discussing earlier, and lack of effective T cell activity. And then the other things as mentioned, the methylated cells, some the methylated MLH1 mutations are less immunogenic and can have a weakened immune response.
This next question comes from Arthur Hsu, who we are fortunate enough to have here at Houston Methodist now. He's asking, why do you think that 35% of patients had immunotherapy rechallenge in the RUBY trial? And was this treatment effective in that setting?
Yeah, that's a great question. Why are people getting rechallenged? For one, I think people think it works, right? I don't think we're trying to, you know, give something to our patients that don't work. It doesn't work. I think we think that it may work. We know that it's an active agent, and without knowing whether there's resistance or not, people just may have, you know, their best, to the best of their knowledge. I don't want to say best guess, but to the best of their knowledge, think that it's a right. You know, we'll get the activity they want. Secondly, and I think equally as important to educate on, there are a lack of second line therapies. So even if you don't think it'll work as good as giving it in the first line, without having good second line options, I think we saw that. Even with that said, you know, Arthur highlights 35% did get retreated. We don't have a lot of follow up data on those patients, so it's tough to really say. All we could say is that rechallenge was common, but the results weren't really recorded, so we can't really comment much on the efficacy.
Okay. Our next question comes from Mathilde Delle from Toulouse in France, and she's asking, rechallenge with checkpoint inhibitor highlights that some patients are no longer sensitive to the treatment upon re-exposure. So would it make sense that a biopsy of the recurrent lesion be required?
Yeah, no. I think that's a great question, and it's not just specifically for immunotherapy, but it's for endometrial cancer and truthfully for a lot of gynecologic cancers in general. We treat heterogeneous diseases, whether it be, again, ovarian cancer, cervical cancer, and now we're talking about endometrial cancer. We treat heterogeneous diseases. What does that mean? The biomarker panels that we test for initially can, I don't know, it's not change over time, but the cells that survive may have a different biomarker profile than when you originally biopsied it. So that's the longer answer. The short answer is yes, I like to rebiopsy, particularly if it's after a period of time, because we can see some differences in what was expressed or not expressed. We can see some relative differences in the tumor mutational burden that we see. So I think it's important. Even, outside the scope of this discussion, HER2 expression. Pedro, as you know, and you and I have talked about this in the past, you may get a HER2 biopsy of 1+ in the hysterectomy, but go back to the endometrial biopsy, it may have been 3+. So something like that for my practice, that gives me a reason to treat with those type of targeted therapies.
Okay. So now we'll go to New York. Mo Byrne, currently a fellow at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and she wants to know about isolated recurrences. She says some have reported that for those with isolated recurrences, local therapy, including surgery or stereotactic radiation, followed by rechallenging immunotherapy, may have a role. What are your perspectives on local therapy?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and really, it's not only a good question, but we're doing this a lot in practice. We're not doing single modality therapy. We're doing surgeries and systemic therapies or radiation. We talked about that a little bit. That local interventions, like surgery or radiation, what it can do is recondition the immune microenvironment, and in turn, that would work synergistically with a checkpoint blockade. What do I mean by that? Radiation, we know, can improve antigen release and T cell priming, and surgery can decrease tumor mass and reduce immunosuppressive signals. These effects may help rechallenge, may improve rechallenge with PD-1 blockade and make it more effective. Evidence in endometrial cancer and with this is limited, but when we look at it in other disease sites, there's a potential benefit. So until proven otherwise, it's hypothesis generating, but definitely worthy of evaluation.
Okay, so Brian, this next question comes from Joanie Nouveau in St. John's, Newfoundland. And she's asking, the paper describes several mechanisms of resistance, including VEGF signaling and JAK mutations, but clinical testing for these isn't routine. So which of these do you think is closest to becoming a practical biomarker in the clinical setting, and what hurdles remain?
Yeah, no. let me start off with an example. We used to talk about alpha folate receptor, years ago, and we'd say, "Wow, that's something that those basic scientists talk about in the lab, but we're never going to talk about in prime time." And then the SORAYA data by Coleman and Moore, and then following up with the MIRASOL data, overnight it made it a biomarker that we all asked for in a newly diagnosed patients. So I think Joanna, you're spot on. We're not testing these routinely, but once we do additional studies, if we could determine which biomarkers are proven to be associated with resistance or are proven to associate with response in a rechallenge setting, then what I think we'll do is we'll take those out of the lab and bring them into clinical practice appropriately. But it takes time, but it's going from the lab to clinical, it takes time, but it happens, like we saw with alpha folate receptor.
Yeah. Now, Mateo Lovero again asking, according to your opinion, which rechallenge options, same agent, class switch, adding anti-VEGF aligns best with specific patient subgroups, MMR status, prior toxicity, time since last immunotherapy? In other words, which patients are appropriate candidates for rechallenge and which regimen would you choose for each?
Yeah, so this is definitely, let me start off by saying that this is my opinion. There's no references for this, but what would I do? And I don't do a lot of it, but there are some patients I would consider. So first of all, if I have a patient who's on, let's say, the Ruby regimen, and she completed her whether it be DMMR or PMMR, she completed her 3 years of maintenance, did well. Maybe, 4 years out, she had a recurrence. And I talked to her about maybe chemotherapy, and she refuses chemotherapy. I would strongly consider giving lenvatinib and pembrolizumab to that patient. One, the patient probably got the benefit from the checkpoint inhibitor. And secondly, we know there's some synergy there with pembro lenvatinib, as Vicky Makker showed in 775. So I think that's one example of adding on a therapy. A patient, let's say a patient's on the same Ruby regimen and they're having problem with potential side effects, perceived side effects of dostarlimab. I would consider then maybe changing that patient over to pembrolizumab or durvalumab. I don't consider that rechallenging, but it's sort of a switch therapy. Now, when you start adding other drugs to the checkpoints, you may be adding the efficacy, but you also may be adding the side effects. GY018 is looking at combining two checkpoint inhibitors. It'll be interesting in a DMMR population. It'll be interesting to see as a rechallenge. But just as much as the efficacy, we want to look at is the side effect profile. Adding lenvatinib to pembrolizumab, I don't, outside the scope of this talk, of the side effects that are associated with lenvatinib, which is a phenomenal drug, but we need to manage the side effects there appropriately. So, it's a good question. A lot of it's sort of like my opinion and, just guessing of where the future will bring us. But I think we'll have to talk about this more seriously in the future.
Great. Tommy Meschini from the University of Insubria in Italy. He's asking, in the ongoing studies evaluating immune checkpoint inhibitor rechallenge in endometrial and other cancers, is rechallenge generally administered until progression, as in most first-line settings, or are fixed duration strategies also being explored as a way to reduce toxicity, treatment burden, and cost?
Listen, I think that most second line studies that we're used to are treat until progression or toxicity. So I think, we're not necessarily leaving them, those patients on quote unquote forever. We've both been a part of studies, Pedro, that we leave a patient on a second line therapy. They do well after a year. We email the study chair and we say, can we take them off? And we say, clinician discretion. So some patients may come off. The GY0, sorry, the NRG GY025 study that I talked about, that's treatment till progression. There was another study that I led actually with Incyte called Podium 204 GOG338. It's not accruing to patients anymore, but we were treating till progression. Those results aren't out yet. So that's what we're doing at this point. Fixed duration and maintenance strategies, I think they're being explored in earlier line therapies. Focusing not only on efficacy and side effect profile, but that's where we stand now.
Okay. Carlotta Sabini from Ospedale San Raffaele in Milano. She's asking, in light of the emerging concept of immune checkpoint inhibitors free interval, and considering that the toxicity of rechallenge is not well defined, is there a minimum washout interval considered safe to resume therapy?
Great question. We don't know. Right. So I think if there is evidence that it works, maybe we'll push to put it early and earlier and just switch over. I think I'm more excited about having patients off of therapy for, a period of time, whether that be 6 months or 12 months. We're not sure. I probably would be a fan of switching over the checkpoint if they're on one certain one to, if we're going to rechallenge, to move to another. But again, this is all hypothetical that we need to take a deeper dive into. I think that the interval alone, it's probably an unreliable predictor. We have to look at other factors as well. I think the most important factor of rechallenging is going to be the drug we combine it with. Because if we, lenvatinib by itself has activity against endometrial cancer. If rechallenging with pembro could boost that up a little bit, then it's worth it. But I think if we're giving it by itself or with a drug that by itself doesn't work against endometrial cancer, it's probably going to be a little bit more difficult.
Yeah. So along those same lines, Paula Mateo from Houston Methodist here also, she's asking, this manuscript states that if long immune checkpoint inhibitor free interval or initial durable responses are observed, rechallenge with the same checkpoint inhibitor may be appropriate. In this scenario, what would be considered a long free interval? would we adopt timelines and terminology similar to chemotherapy, such as platinum sensitive or platinum resistant?
It's a tough question, right? Well, first of all, it reminds me of like fellowship. If you ask a question, you don't like the answer, wait 5 minutes and ask the question again. I think it was a similar question to last time. But I think my answer is going to sort of, I haven't changed my view yet. But thanks for the question. We don't know the time, you know, forget about IO, endometrial cancer. We never thought about platinum resistant versus platinum sensitive disease until the current FDA approvals now say if you're treated with a platinum, you need to retreat with a platinum if they're 6 months or 12 months disease free. So we don't know about that in endometrial cancer. It's something that we're definitely going to be focusing on to see if there is a time period off of treatment that matters. But we're not there yet. But we'll have to see.
Okay. This question again comes from Matilde Dell. She's asking, numerous early phase clinical trials are currently investigating WRN helicase inhibitors. What's the mechanism of action of these agents, their route of administration, and the expected adverse effects?
Yeah, so I think this is the area that I'm most excited about, these type of inhibitors, especially in the patients with MSI high or the dMMR tumors. I think they may have its greatest role. It's crucial. The WRN helicase is crucial for maintaining what we call the accuracy of DNA replication in microsatellite unstable cells. When we block this helicase, those cells that can't repair properly and undergo synthetic lethality, while normal MMR proficient cells are far less affected. Right now, they are being developed as oral small molecules, and early phase trials are already enrolling patients with MSI tumors and even endometrial cancers. As far as side effects, this is a DNA repair target. As we expect, we'll see some myelosuppression, GI toxicity, you know, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, probably some fatigue, more in line with small molecule inhibitor therapies. But preclinical data suggests possible off-target effects as well on fast dividing cells. But so far, there's no signal for unusual immune-related toxicity. Super excited about it. And it seems like some of the smaller biopharms are starting to investigate it, which is exciting.
Great. Masha Pervin from University Hospital Münster in Germany, she asked, should patients who reach complete response with an immune checkpoint inhibitor stop treatment to limit toxicity and allow more effective rechallenge at subsequent recurrences?
So I'll take that question in two parts. As far as stopping therapy, so what we did in GY018, Ramez Iskander did is they stopped therapy after 3 years of maintenance therapy. In Ruby, we stopped it after 2 years. I'm sorry, I think I said that wrong. Ruby was 3 years, GY018 was 2 years. I think durvalumab, the DOE, if I'm not mistaken, continued till progression. So we do have times that we stop it. As far as the longer the time away, will that help response? Short answer is we don't know, but that would be good to know. For example, if we know it's better to respond to rechallenge after a year, maybe we'll start maximizing Ruby to 2 years so we could get a benefit of it down the road. But right now, we don't know the answer.
So this next question, I'm sure you'll have tons of data to support your answer, comes from Arthur Hsu here in Houston Methodist. He is asking, a question now often brought up in tumor boards is that patients with disease-free after immunotherapy, now the patient has nothing on imaging scans, but they have ctDNA positive. Is this the timing for rechallenging with treatment with immunotherapy? What do you do in your clinical practice with the positive ctDNA?
Yeah, or Arthur's ahead of himself. I mean, no, it's a great question. And I used to answer the question, because I've gotten this question before. It's a great question. I used to say, well, it's not ready for prime time. Next question, please. But I could tell you, ctDNA evaluation is not going away. And we need to look at this data. We need to cherish this data. We need to do retrospective reviews on this data, because we are getting real world data on the ctDNA levels on patients. Maybe it will predict recurrence. Maybe it'll predict time to recurrence. Maybe it's completely useless. I don't know. And we won't be testing it. But a lot of people are using it. I was resistant to use it in my practice. Now I'm fine. Honestly, I'm using it more and more. The answer to those tumor boards is I don't know at this point.
Just a couple more questions. Joni Naval, she's asking, if you had to bet on one avenue that could change the treatment landscape for patients progressing after first-line immunotherapy, which approach do you think holds the greatest promise?
Yeah. So if we had to change the treatment landscape for patients progressing on immunotherapy, as I was sort of alluding to, I would go towards probably combinations. The other thing I really haven't talked about is like, wait a minute, let's take a delay. Let's give them an ADC, give them more of an IO-free interval, and maybe that'll do something beneficial for the tumor. I don't know. But I think at this point, it's probably going to be the combinations that I'm most excited about. PD-1 or PD-L1s plus anti-angiogenic therapy. And we know that VEGF drives immunosuppression and blocking this pathway can have benefit in a lot of cancers like lenvatinib or cedirinib. Maybe that'll come into practice soon. We're studying, as mentioned, GY025 nivolumab with ipilimumab as another promising combination. And then again, the WRN inhibitors that we sort of just dove into, I think, is a possibility, particularly for the DMMR tumors.
Great. So, Brian, as a new tradition here in the podcast, the last question is a question that has been generated by artificial intelligence when AI read your paper. So the question is, do real-world retreatment practices, such as those observed in the RUBY trial, where 35% of patients received subsequent immunotherapy off protocol, reflect clinical innovation or a lack of discipline that undermines the generation of high-quality evidence?
Yeah, that's a pretty aggressive question by AI. Was that ChatGPT or another version? Reflect clinical innovation, possibly. A lack of discipline, definitely not. I mean, a lack of discipline is sort of negative connotations. I think rather than saying lack of discipline, I'd say no better options, perhaps. There's a lot to learn. And again, I thought it was a good question. Almost as a summary statement, I used to be against it. I used to say, no way, IO after IO, you can't do it. Right. And then obviously, it's not what I say, it's what people are doing. And we're seeing it more and more. And some of the retrospective studies does have some signals. Let me call out Peter Rosa's study of 8 patients, DMMR tumors, when they retreated them, 75% responded. DMMR, when they retreated them with IOs, adding lenvatinib. So there is a role. There's going to be a role for some patients. I'm excited about further investigation that's going to dive into this, that's going to help us elucidate which patients may benefit or not. I don't think physicians are doing anything negligent or cavalier by trying it. I think we're trying what's best for our patients. But it would be great if we could figure out and then through clinical trial prove best ways to rechallenge our patients that'll get appropriate efficacy without and it's tolerable without too much toxicity.
Well, Brian, thank you so much. Once again, always a pleasure speaking with you. Always so impressed by the amount of information and knowledge that we gained from these discussions. Congratulations once again on all of the work that you continue to do and the support that you provide to all of us institutions in guiding us as to what is the next best trial from the cooperative groups like the GOG partners. Thank you for what you contribute to the care of patients with gynecologic cancers. And again, extremely, extremely proud of you and having been a mentor to you when you were in our fellowship.
Yeah, no, Pedro, thank you so much. Again, I really appreciate it. I can't, we've talked about this in the past, but most importantly, I think our friendship and our desire to always do what's best for our patients. Really appreciate this opportunity and hopefully I look forward to future discussions.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks.